Good afternoon. Good evening. When does afternoon change to evening? 5 o'clock? Okay. Good afternoon. Thanks for being here at this university colloquium for October. I'm very happy to welcome Holmes Rolston here for this afternoon's presentation. This is a little bit of a homecoming for him. If you were in chapel this morning, you heard that his ancestors are buried at Cooks Creek Church Cemetery, and that he himself was born and raised here in the Shenandoah Valley. So welcome home. If you were there this morning, you also heard Christian Early introduce him as an academic rock star. That may sound a little bit like an oxymoron, but his credentials probably justify it. He's a well-known scholar and writer in the philosophy of science. He's studied, did his undergraduate work at Davidson College, not too far from home, but he's studied at Union Theological Seminary. He's an ordained Presbyterian minister, did a PhD at the University of Edinburgh, also studied at the University of Pittsburgh, and he has a long list of very prominent books in the area of science and religion. He's going to be talking to us today about a recent book entitled The Three Big Bangs. He's been awarded the Templeton Prize in Religion. He's also given the Gifford Lectures at the University of Edinburgh and a long list here of academic awards that I won't bother to read all of them. But just to say that Christian's introduction this morning wasn't hyperbole. Holmes, welcome to the podium. We're very eager to hear what you have for us.
Thank you. It is nice to be back in the valley, Shenandoah Valley, and to be able to think about ask big questions, if you like. Coming sort of back home. My topic is Three Big Bangs. Once upon a time, Plato said that what philosophers need to do is to carve nature at the joints. If you ever carve a turkey, it's a good idea to try to carve at the joints. You might say what I'm going to do is carve nature at the explosions, if you like. That's to say, I'm thinking about, three big bangs? You've all heard of a first big bang, which is the startup of the universe, at least this universe. I'm going to call a second big bang the explosion, if you like, of life on Earth, which I think has in some sense been a spectacular event. Third Big Bang, it's in your head. It's a question of mind in nature. Well, Big Bang is a sort of a metaphor. If I wanted to put it more sort of technically, I'm after the idea that certain events have radically new consequences, new possibilities. You could call them three big singularities. And I want to offset the idea that what's rare is unimportant. I think in some sense, scientists often think that what's rare is quite revealing. Well, let's think first about an original Big Bang, the cosmic Big Bang. And it has many interesting characteristics. It's a kind of, singularity. It happened a long time ago, billions of years ago, and there was indeed an explosion. The infant universe, we were told, expanded faster than the speed of light. And so we have a kind of a fireball at the start of our universe, and then it radically inflates. And in a sense, it, the universe has been expanding ever since. NASA pictures it like this, initial inflation in the left hand, and then a universe that's been continually getting bigger. And it turns out that the conditions at the beginning of the universe were unique. Kind of a fancy word for that is idiographic. And yet in such way that it produced a universe that is law-like. A fancy word for that is nomothetic. We get physicists who now say they're going to get a theory of everything. They mostly mean by that a kind of theory of these beginning forces, a theory of how it is that our universe has the particular features it has. The theory of everything is, in a certain sense, pretty arrogant. We have a Harvard astronomer who says it's a horrible misnomer. It doesn't have anything to do with how to solve getting over the financial cliff or those sorts of things. But maybe it does have to do with the sort of foundations. Paul Davies says it's a theory of how we hit a cosmic jackpot. And now we want to ask about the features of this early universe that make it so interesting. Paul Davies says it's a universe that turns out to be just right for life. Davies, a well-known astronomer. You might say, well, it doesn't exactly seem like the universe is still exploding. And yet, it is an old universe, but it still has an expansion rate. Some people think it's increasing in its expansion. Here's John Barra, a Cambridge cosmologist. Many of the features of our vast universe, lonely, dark in space, but we wouldn't be here if space, the heavens, weren't like that. They are conditions for intelligent observers. This may be called the anthropic principle. I wish it had been called the biogenic principle. That's to say, there's something about the features of the physical world that, well, result in the creation of life, in the creation of humans. Much of this has to do with the four fundamental forces. All of us know something about gravity and magnetism. Two other forces are only sort of inside the nucleus, the weak and the strong nuclear force. But the general idea is that if these weren't about the same, the universe wouldn't work. The proton and electron are very different size particles, different weight particles, but they have an identical charge, and without that, there wouldn't be any chemistry. There's a thing called the cosmological constant, lambda, it's often abbreviated, and it actually is quite small. It's 10 to the minus 20th power. If you've forgotten your decimal system, it's quite small. Are you getting the idea? It's quite small. Thank goodness it's got something to it. But it's quite small. But if it weren't, it can't be zero and have the universe work as it does. Here's Martin Rees, a well-known British astronomer. It describes the weakest force in nature, quite mysterious, but it controls the universe's expansion and fate. Our existence requires that lambda not be too large. And we could go on at some length about this, but we have other things to think about. There's a fine structure constant. Looks something like this. It too is quite small, but if it were a little stronger, there wouldn't be any carbon, there wouldn't be any protein chemistry. In fact, you know, for life we need both carbon and oxygen, and the ratio, all the heavy elements, past hydrogen and helium, are made in the stars. If things were much different, we wouldn't have the amounts of carbon and oxygen that make life possible. Here's Fred Hoyle, a British astronomer, who, despite what he says here, did not think of himself as believing in God. Looking at the carbon-oxygen formation ratio, it's kind of like a fine-tuned radio sort of thing. If you get just a little bit off the readings, you don't get the signal. Some supercalculating intellect must have designed these properties. Otherwise, you wouldn't find atoms like carbon, oxygen. You would conclude that the carbon atom is a kind of fix. Something has monkeyed with the physics. You see, you are made of carbon and oxygen and nitrogen and many things like that. Not the hydrogen. You've got a lot of hydrogen inside of you as well. But all that other stuff is, if you like, fossil stardust. You know, or if you're having a gloomy day, you could think of yourself as nuclear waste. Now, you may hear that, well, yes, but the formation of all these things is automatic. It's a kind of self-organizing thing. Maybe so, but here's Peter Ward, John Brownlee, a paleontologist. They say it's remarkable, isn't it, in some sense, that Earth got it right. We got it right because of elements formed in the stars. And now we want to wonder to ourselves, well, did it have to be like that? Is that predictable, or is it in some sense surprising? I think some features of the physical world, we could say, are determined by the characteristics of the first Big Bang. A really smart chemist might have seen the beginnings of the periodic table in every chemistry lecture hall in the country. Already beginning in the Big Bang, a really smart mineralogist might have seen there are going to be 32 crystal classes. A good chemist might have said, well, if there's a water molecule, it's got two ends like a water molecule does. Maybe somebody could have been there at the Big Bang and said, One day there's going to be rivers, canyons, oceans. So in that sense, you might say that much of what has happened is sort of front-loaded into the system. But not all of it is front-loaded in the system. If you can imagine some people from outer space flying by Saturn, one said, well, that's a kind of an interesting planet, isn't it? Got rings. And they fly by Jupiter and they say, that's kind of interesting. And they fly by Mars, and it's a red planet. It's kind of an interesting planet. But one of these extraterrestrials says, yeah, but I just can't wait to see elephants on Earth. It doesn't work too well, doesn't it? There kind of isn't any way you could know that there are going to be elephants on Earth. They aren't sort of front-loaded into the system, if you like. Roger Penrose, paleontologist, cosmologist, it's an extraordinarily special Big Bang. Not all physicists take that view. Steven Weinberg's an excellent physicist, and he says, the more you learn about the universe, the more it seems pointless. But there are a lot of ways in which looking at things, you could say that in a certain sense, the startup looks like a setup. A setup because millions, billions of years later, explosion of life on Earth. And now we get the idea that on Earth what's different is an explosion of information, says Richard Dawkins, with whom I don't often agree, but I agree in this situation. And now we can find plenty of paleontologists who say that the appearance of life on Earth in the seas and on land, well, here it's an exponential increase, at least since the Precambrian times. Here's another Steve Stanley, University of Hawaii. Empirical record represents exponential increase. Or here's a Dutch paleontologist, now UC Davis. Escalation characterizes the history of evident life. Well, what's going on? What's different? I studied physics when I was in college. The physicists say, well, there's two kinds of things. There's matter, there's energy. Einstein came along and said, yeah, but the two go together. There's matter, energy. That's what I was taught. But when I went across the campus, the biologist said, well, yeah, but we've got something the physicists don't know about. We've got information. Okay, now you're getting the idea that in DNA, in genetic coding, there's a kind of information about how to maintain, elaborate vital processes. It's a case of sort of directed use. It's a case of information escalating and crossing certain critical thresholds. It involves what we call a combinatorial explosion. What's a combinatorial explosion? You like big numbers? Well, here's a big number. You get it out of astronomy, big number. No, if you like big numbers now, where you need to get really big numbers is not in the heavens above, but in Earth beneath. In biology, you get numbers called immense, 10 to the 110th power. Well, what do you need to get that number? You get that number, the different ways you can organize a short protein molecule. Or if you look at a longer molecule and the different ways you can organize it, you get a DNA strand that mammals can be organized 10 raised to 10 raised to the 8th power. Okay, it's called hyper-immense numbers. Well, maybe you can help think of this about thinking about the sentences on a keyboard. How many sentences can you write on a keyboard? A couple of thousand and then you're done? You got 26 letters. You got some punctuation marks, uppercase, lowercase, spaces. Oh, maybe you could write a million sentences, then you'd be done. Well, no, you get the idea that you could almost write new sentences forever, write new stories, write new novels, because there's a big combinatorial explosion of the sorts of things you could do on a keyboard. Now, the idea is that nature does something like that. It sort of rings the changes, exploring, adapted, fit, and that produces an immense evolutionary epic. Here's Andy Knoll, teaches at Harvard, a scientific account of Earth's history abounds in verve and mystery. We got two things to explain. We've got to explain why there are so many different kinds of things. And we've also got to explain why things get more complex. Here's J.W. Valentine, UC Berkeley, Standard Text in Paleontology. A major trend has been more and more numerous units at all levels of the hierarchy. It's become, put it more simply, a splitter's paradise. Lots of diversity, but Valentine continues, well, there's a kind of improvement. The background fluctuates, gets wetter, gets drier, gets colder, yes, but there's a kind of gradually rising average complexity. Now, you may say, well, evolution I always thought was kind of slow. There's even talk of times when evolution changes very little. And yet, there's certain biological processes that are pretty fast. That results in part from what catalysts, there's certain kinds of enzymes that speed up processes millions of times. There are women in front of me who have given birth to an infant child. The fetal brain, while you were carrying that child, was making 250,000 neurons a minute. That's, I think, a lot of fast productivity. Or if we think of the DNA molecule, which you see here. This is a DNA molecule replicating itself, moving through a thing here called blue, called a helicase. This is happening pretty fast. If you could enlarge this speed at which this is taking place, it's happening faster than the jet plane at which with which I flew across the country. So now we've got a lot of feed loops, feedback loops. These will have to settle into some sort of equilibrium often. Natural selection requires order. Yes, you can't have natural selection without some stability. And yet natural selection requires a lot of change, sometimes rapid change. You got to have reliable life support, and you've got to have challenging new opportunities. And when that happens, you get what the biologists call the Cambrian explosion. Japanese paleontologist thinks that over time, there has been an increase of evolution at the rate of about a third of a bit per generation over many generations. And we have here the idea that there was an explosion of marine communities. And similarly on land, Doug Irwin is in the Smithsonian. We've got the idea that the Cenozoic area was a spectacular diversification. Man here, geology, UC Davis. Others say, well, there was a highly creative phases in evolutionary history. And then we can have the idea that what essentially what you're getting is this marvelous molecule, and what you're getting is the transmission not so much of matter but of information. And John Maynard Smith, a philosopher of biology, biologist, thinks there are critical stages in which new kinds of information becomes possible. You have to get the genetic code, of course, in the beginning. And then when you get the genetic code, you're going to have to do what? You're going to have to learn how to elaborate it. And how is that going to happen? Well, it helps to concentrate the genetic material in the nucleus. That's what a eukaryote is. So when you concentrate it, you can deal with information much more rapidly. When you have sex, you can exchange information in breeding and crossbreeding. And when you get cellular life, you can have some cells that are liver cells and other cells that are brain cells. And when you get societies, animal societies, language, human language, these are essentially, he says, critical changes that have taken place in the transmission of information. Now we're getting the idea that the genetic program is really a kind of sophisticated information processing. Here's James Shapiro, University of Chicago. Here's Christian Dedeux, Belgian Nobel Prize winner. There are certain landmarks or certain singularities on the way to life. You repeatedly discover that you've got to go through certain paths or channels, and then there gets escalation. You've got some things that happen similarly again and again, and you get, he says, a lot of fantastic good luck. Maynard Smith, I quoted a few minutes ago, Christian Dedeux differ. Maynard Smith thinks all this is surprising, unexpected. Christian to do thinks it's to be expected. Darwin once spoke of dissent with modification. What I'm saying now is we get that to be kind of assent with modification. Maynard Smith says, the genetic code and human language are capable of indefinitely large number of messages. Or here's Manfred Eigen, German thermodynamicist. The key word in more complexity is information. And now we get the idea that life is a kind of organized information state, which is different from anything in the physical world. Genes are doing something with a view to the future, something that doesn't yet exist. So you've got a kind of knowledge in the genes which knows how to look for and find and make use of biological resources. Or if you like, in chemistry there are factors, but in biology, we get actors. Or if you like, the genes know how to do what a couple of biologists here call facilitated variation. They know how to do trial and error solutions. The genes know how to generate new possibilities and test them. Well, you can think in a way, if you like, that this is happening from the bottom up. Cells gather together and become multiple cells. You get compounded and recompounded diversity. It happens from the bottom up, but you get some surprises. Surprises are often involve what's called co-option, when new things happen that are in a certain sense as revolutionary as they are evolutionary. For example, you get an existing gene which evolved to do one thing, but it and its product turns out to be lucky and to be used in a new way. For example, heat stress proteins, an ancient protein, they didn't break up when it got hot. Well, what happened? They happen to be crystals, all right? And so they are put to work in ice, which they didn't evolve to do, but in which they work very well. Or even life moving on to land, their lazy fish had swim bladders that helped them float rather than swim. These had air in them, and they are transmuted into lungs. And I think, interestingly, what are called mitochondria, chloroplasts, which you can get some idea of in this diagram, the blue line is sort of one kind of early organism, and the green line is plants, and the red line is animals. Okay, you have this crossing over. In the lower part of the mitochondria, maybe once as parasites, but they become the power organelles with which we are staying alive, the sort of major energy sources. But later on, the plastids or chloroplasts cross over and become the chloroplast in plants that make photosynthesis possible. See, now I'm saying there are surprises. You wouldn't necessarily predict that there'd be elephants on Earth. You wouldn't necessarily predict that the history of life would be like this. But it's sort of undeniable that there has been this kind of increase in complexity. Here's Ernst Mayr, sort of the granddaddy of all biologists at Harvard, died a few years back. Who can deny, he says, that there's a kind of overall progress? Things get a better organized nucleus, and he continues that they're single-celled, and later they become multiple-celled plants and animals with highly specialized organs. They are cold-blooded animals, and they later become warm-blooded animals with much more capacity to control their metabolism. And there are those with large central nervous systems and the capacity to transmit information from generation to generation. By now you're probably saying, well, I knew that this talk was going to be a bit too complicated for me. Maybe you'd like to see some graphs, some pictures. Now just get impressions. You can't read all this detail. So here's a graph of all organisms, high and low estimates, two graphs, over evolutionary time, right? Here's a graph of these organisms on the continents, which doesn't begin until Ordovician and Silurian times. Here's a graph of these organisms in the sea. And you may say, well, it looks kind of flat in the middle, which it does. That's the time, though, when life moved on to land. I'll show you three kind of graphs that I'll connect up. Here's an early graph, Silurian-Devonian times. Just get impressions. You can't read the details. There are lycopods in there that's like running cedar in the woods. Okay, but now let's continue in evolutionary time, and we get to another graph. Oh, there are cycads and ferns in there, and lycopods, and the beginnings of different kinds of things we know. But you might say, well, that looks kind of flat, like life isn't changing, but it isn't increasing very much. And if we come forward yet more in evolutionary time, you may say, okay, now it's getting more interesting. Life is increasing. But maybe you weren't watching the scales. If I put those three together, here's the last graph. And if I say, watch the scale, there's the middle graph, and there's the first graph. See, now you get the impression, I think, diversity starts low and ends high over evolutionary time. Or if you want to, those were plants, the previous one. If you want to look at vertebrates, here's a graph. Again, you've got reptiles and you've got birds and different sorts of things in there. Well, you get the impression that it's, what, increasing and sometimes almost explosively increasing over evolutionary time. Now we want to ask ourselves, well, yes, but it's kind of all this built into the system. Possibilities, are, you know, is it all kind of hanging around in the quarks that there are going to be elephants? So forth. Is it sort of always possible? Well, it must have been possible if it happened. It must have always been possible. No. Other people say, well, no, it may be that new possibilities come into being with this novel information. So now it may be that layer by layer we get new possibilities, we get historical novelty. It's not simply sort of adding on a little bit more here and a little bit more there. It's true that DNA is a linear molecule, but when you add it up and rearrange it in different ways, it folds differently, and you get whole new search space. Karl Popper is one of the better-known philosophers of science. Here's a somewhat longer quotation from him, thinking that biology is different, right? Because the possibilities are always changing. And it allows us to see in a new way these processes because we're getting folding and unfolding of new possibility space, explosive possibility space, especially in biochemistry. Every new kind of molecule compound creates possibilities that did not previously exist. So the possibility space is going, and you get staggering number of organisms, and we ourselves become possible. Okay. Big Bang, an explosive life on Earth. Human being starts out as one cell. We all started out as one cell. You got something like 10 to the 13th power cells. You got something like 200 cell types. If the DNA in your body were uncoiled, it would reach to the sun and back 6 times. That's the information in your body. Just in your genes, we are coming quite soon to mind. Neurons develop. First, they are not central like jellyfish, diffuse neurons, but they become a central nervous system. Life develops a kind of psyche. Life gets, if you like, psyched up. So now I'm finding in my story of the universe that life starts up, but life smarts up as well as starts up, and it smarts up most of all in this marvelous human mind. You're seeing different body shapes there. I'm more interested in what's going on in that head. Here's a graph of what's going on in that head. Let's get an impression from millions of years before the present. Not much change in brain volume. Then it takes almost a right angle turn and eventuates in the human mind. Ed Wilson, Harvard University. No organ in the history of life has grown faster. Steve Doris, genetics, University of Chicago. Human evolution is characterized by a dramatic increase in brain size and complexity. Interestingly, I think here the geneticists have decoded the human genome, a marvelous accomplishment. And they, you know, when they do a write-up, they say, well, interestingly, though we've decoded the gene, human gene, it's not exactly the number of neurons or the number of cells that correlates with complexity. Between humans and chimps, there's not all that much difference in gene function. Cell types, almost indistinguishable in much of their anatomy, all right? But the development modifications with humans, expanding the voice box, expanding the cortex, giving rise to language, resulted in a massive singularity that makes humans more complex in any sense. And we wonder if our real challenge is not finding out yet ahead how this mechanism of our body can explain how our minds have become so organized as to think about our own existence, right? This is 200 geneticists saying that genes don't tell the whole story. Here's Bruce Lahn, University of Chicago. Human evolution is a privileged process, a level of selection that's unprecedented. Or here's Bruce Lahn continuing. Humans occupy a unique position in the tree of life. Evolution has been working very hard to produce us. Here's Michael Gazzaniga, a neuroscientist. We humans are hugely different. The differences between us and the chimpanzees are light years apart. Well, we heard that our anatomy in many ways is very similar, but now we're hearing that we're light years apart. Well, animals are conscious. It's interesting that consciousness emerges. Here's Jerry Fodor. We really don't know how matter can become conscious. We don't have an idea how to get a bit of an idea how matter could become conscious, but we get an explosive state change with the human mind, which we don't know. Some 40,000, 100,000 years ago, we get radical new possibilities. See, genes can't make a mind. Of course, genes make neurons, but genes can't wire up the mind because genes don't have enough information in them. You can't store that much information in genes. The human mind is huge in its number of neurons and the number of synaptic connections it can make. And so, particularly in our minds, we hear here from Wolfgang Enard, changes have been particularly pronounced in the brain with striking differences between humans and their closest relatives. We're dealing with what I call and others call a theory of mind. Here's Dan Povinelli. Humans have a theory of mind that chimps don't have. Okay, what's going on? The idea is that humans learn from one another in ways that non-humans animals do not. Humans have very powerful forms of social cognition. They can understand and take the perspective of others in ways that non-humans cannot. Let's think about this in terms of teaching. Now, we hear people say there's no teaching in chimpanzees. You got to know what teaching means. Teaching does not simply mean imitated behavior. Everybody knows that chimps imitate the behavior of other chimps. In the barnyards in which I grew up, the chicks, mother hen would scratch, and the chicks would scratch. They imitate her behavior. But that, in this sense, is not yet teaching. Oh, I gotta go back up a bit. Because teaching involves the instructor paying attention to how well the students are learning. Okay. Teaching requires language in which the adult is not simply imitated, but in which the teacher corrects the pupil, and that requires language. And as far as we know, in that sense, animals do not communicate. Never takes on these open-ended possibilities of what? Essentially carrying ideas from mind to mind to mind. Well, you say, oh, I was taught a while back that monkeys have words. They have a different word for snake, a different word for leopard, a different word for eagle. And that's true, they make different sounds when they see these different sorts of things. But they aren't exactly words. It's just kind of like you see a snake in the woods, you say, oh, and you see another sort of animal, you see a bear in the woods, you say, woohoo, and you see another kind of bird in the sky, and you say, oh, right? So these are kind of different noises that they make in the presence of different kind of animals. But the linguists say now that these ought not to be thought of as words. They aren't taking into account what others believe or want. Why not? May they make these words whether other chimpanzees are around or not, if you want to call them words. Okay, now you may have heard that humans are not sort of anymore in center focus. We arrived on this planet late. There's only one species like ourselves. Copernicus taught us that our planet's not even the center of the universe. Darwin taught us that we evolved out of the animals. Watson and Crick taught us that with DNA, organized molecules. Freud taught us that much that goes on in our minds is unconscious. Okay. Yes and no. It seems to me that what we have learned studying the mind is that humans are still at the center of complexity. Yes, we are quite small on the cosmic scale, although we are pretty good size on the molecular scale. But what I think we are learning is that we are infinitely complex. In that sense, you may hear that the tree of life is bushy. It has different kind of branches, and it may say in some books that we're just a kind of another branch on the tree. Yes and no. There's been a kind of a mental explosion in human life. We've crossed the threshold with radical new powers. Here's Terry Deacon he's on the West Coast, UC Berkeley, I think he is. Humans, hundreds of millions of years have produced hundreds of thousands of species with brains, but can do lots of different things that we can't do. Wolves can smell like we can't. Bats can fly in the dark and catch insects, yes. But we have remarkable abilities to wonder about the world. We are the only species that has evolved the ability to do so. Christensen and Kirby say, why and how humans get their mind is the hardest problem in science. Well, what's going on? The idea now is in teaching in human cultures and accumulation of human cultures that ideas pass from mind to mind to mind to mind. We've got, like, if you like, knowledge at a distance. You're learning what happened in medieval Europe. Well, you might say chimps have a theory of mind. One chimp may know that the other chimp knows where the bananas are hidden. Right? But, well, if you want to put it that way, humans have an ideational mind. I know the Pythagorean theorem and you don't. And I can teach you the Pythagorean theorem, which has crossed down across thousands of years. Right? So it's this idea of passing ideas from mind to mind that makes us remarkably different. Yes, a mouse has a brain. A mouse in a small pinhead of a mouse brain has got a lot of dendrites, axons. These are parts of the neuron that transmits signals. Humans have got 3,000 times the brains of mice. We've got 3 or 4 times the brains of chimps. If you were to take these parts of your neurons and stretch them out, they would wrap around the Earth 40 times. So now we've got the idea that our brains are different. They're remarkably great in their cognitive capacities. Seth Grant's, the mind has to pass signals from one cell to another across what's called a synapse. Seth Grant says that the postsynaptic side of the synapse is the most complex structure in the body, some 1,200 different kinds of proteins governing the way signals are transmitted. Well, you wanted big numbers a while back. This is how many atoms you've got in your brain. Yeah, that's not a very big number, you may say. Didn't I say a while back there are 10 to the 80th power protons in the universe? Okay. Are you ready? You got this many possible thoughts in your brain. I mean, this thought alone is worth your staying this long and listening to this lecture. We've got what are called mutable maps. We've got not just bottom-up, but top-down causation. That's to say, what appears and emerges can shape and control the precedents. So here's a neurologist at UC San Francisco. The most remarkable capacity of our brains is we can shape our own achievements. If you want that, think of violin players, young women who learn to play violins. Practice resolutely. For 3 or 4 years, you need to move one arm fingers this way, another arm to move the bow across the violin. These young girls rewire their brains. You think London taxi driver's pretty smart, don't you, to get you around in London. It takes about 4 years for a driver, mostly men, some women, to learn how to take you to an address in London. Guess what? It turns out when they do that, they rewire their brains, devoting much more brain space to location and topography. If you're a good juggler, when learning to juggle, you rewire your brain. All right? If you learn a second language, you maybe thought you had to do this. Learn a second language, or even a first language, you rewire your brain. So childhood, adult education, teaching at Eastern Mennonite University is rewiring the brains of your students. Okay, so we have a remarkable mind that can do lots of things. We can build instruments, we can construct theories, we can think from quarks to quasars, we can think about distances across 40 orders of magnitude, from picometers to the extent of the universe. We can think about strength forces across 40 orders of magnitude, from gravity, a relatively weak force, to the strong nuclear force. We can think about time across some 34 orders of magnitude, from attoseconds to billions of years. See, humans are an animal that can transcend their own sector as no other animals can do. We can think about Earth seen from space. We can think about those elephants and how they have a low-frequency elephant community. We can think about three big bangs, as we are doing now. Well, you might say, well, of course, but intelligence makes us smarter. It selects for survival, but not always. A few years back, there was always a conjecture, Poincaré. Perelman proved it, a mathematician. This has to do with how to transform one kind of space to another. I doubt that Perelman was leaving more children in the next generation while he was figuring out this proof. I even doubt that Ed Wilson studying his ants, right, and finding splendor in them is simply doing something that leaves more children in the next generation. Because I think humans have a remarkable capacity to orient the mind to the whole. We become self-transcending spirits. We become free spirits. We can create ideologies, affirm creeds. We can debate our rights, our responsibilities. We can worship God. We are remarkably distinct from the other millions of species. Well, maybe we don't know whether it all takes place by chance or whether it's probable, whether there are some selective tendencies, whether it happens by necessity, by design. Yes, some things are still over our heads, but we are increasingly sure that what's in our heads is as important as what's over our heads. Here's Einstein. The eternal mystery of the world is its comprehensibility. Here's Ralston improving on Einstein. The eternal mystery of the universe is its generating of comprehending mind. Mind, the gap. Science gives us three principal data points, three big bangs: matter, energy, life, mind. Well, the first of these is universal. The second, life, is rare, maybe elsewhere in the universe, but rare. The third is single, and we are it. Now you may say, well, yes, each of these steps supersedes the precedents, but my friends will say there's no supernature, but nature is super. Nature is supercharged. Maybe, but maybe this supercharged nature in the human mind signals a transcendent presence. That is, there's logos in, with, and under our mind, our presence embraced by this deeper presence. Thank you, and if you want more, it's all in a book of mine. I'll be down front to answer questions for a while.
Thank you very much. Might I suggest that we move the Q&A to Common Grounds? We'll have a light reception there, and you can interact with Holmes and enjoy a few munchies. See you there.